drawing inspiration from the river.
If you live near the river, presence is the word that I would use to describe it, that it's always there. It's always in the back of your thoughts, even if it's not in the forefront. Culturally, the location of the river here has attracted all kinds of creative people, and the institutions that foster them, from our colleges and universities to our museums. And the fact that the river has drawn so many creative people near it has a self-perpetuating quality.
That's writer, artist, and historian Russell Powell. In this, our last episode in our special series, The River Runs Through Us, Powell talks with Drew Adamack about the intersection of the natural world and our place within it. And we also hear some highlights from previous episodes in the series. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice.
Russell Stephen Powell is a publisher, writer, artist, poet, filmmaker, blogger, and agricultural historian based in Hatfield, Massachusetts. For decades, he's written about the arts, the environment, agriculture, and education in the Connecticut River watershed. From 2006 to 2007, he published a journal of culture, arts, and ideas, as well as the landscape and history of the Connecticut River corridor called the New England Watershed. In addition to his journalism work, he's published extensively as a poet, made several documentary films, and publicly exhibited his paintings. He is also the senior writer for the New England Apple Association. Powell has also published a cultural history of the apple called America's Apples. He has a new book about New England apples coming out in 2014 called A Field Guide to New England Apples. Powell's work is deeply committed to the intersection of the natural landscape and our presence in it. His work searches for meaning in the natural world and finds it in paying attention to the subtle, the present, and the ever-changing landscape. Examples of his writing and his artwork can be found at his blog, russpowell.net. I spoke with Russell about the inspiration he draws from the Connecticut River, the sense of community created by the river, and the best way to explore our natural world. Russell, thank you so much for joining us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Throughout this series, The River Runs Through Us, we've examined the historical, spiritual, and economic issues and metaphors and relationships that people have with the river. But you seem to be uniquely suited to talk about all of these things in that you're a writer, a blogger, an agricultural historian, a visual artist. Tell us a little bit about your professional and creative relationship to the river and to the Connecticut River Valley watershed.
I've lived near the river since the early 1980s when I was a print journalist in Plainfield, New Hampshire. And I've been in the lower valley now since the late 1980s. And for many years have made my living as a writer, both in journalism and marketing and public relations, and especially writing about agriculture over the last 20 years.
When did you first begin to notice the Connecticut River as an influential creative force in your work?
I think it really spiked in 2001 when I moved to Hatfield. I had lived in Amherst since the late 1980s. And while I was certainly aware of the river as a huge presence in my landscape, it was only when I moved to Hatfield and began walking to the river every day and every season that it became a real force.
Tying into that, I want to read something that you've written, and if you would talk a little bit about it and what it means, and I'm going to read a rather long quote here. "We who live in the Connecticut River watershed generally have more in common than we generally acknowledge. What we have in common is not an abstraction. The river is the most obvious symbol of our connection, a natural feature of undeniable grandeur, our region's metaphorical spine," end quote. What do you mean by that, and how is that real for you in your work?
I think it really has defined us in major ways. While we do have a significant east-west route with Interstate 90, in fact, most of our lives are organized around the north-south route on Interstate 91, and that in turn is defined by the Connecticut River. We drive over it on our way to work or to shop. We have to make choices. There are only half a dozen bridges from Massachusetts to Connecticut. So you are forced to deal with the river anytime you want to go anywhere outside your immediate vicinity.
But as a connection, both personally and to the community, as a metaphorical spine, what are the spiritual and creative insights that the river gives you, not just as a physical landmark in our landscape, but as a creative force?
I think some of it is natural history and some of it is cultural history. I think water has a very powerful influence on us in any locale, whether it's the ocean or a stream or a pond. And this is one of our oldest rivers, and it cuts through several states, four states in western New England. It has a very deep presence. If you live near the river, presence is the word that I would use to describe it, that it's always there. It's always in the back of your thoughts, even if it's not in the forefront. Culturally, the location of the river here has attracted all kinds of creative people and the institutions that foster them, from our colleges and universities to our museums. And the fact that the river has drawn so many creative people near it has a self-perpetuating quality.
You mentioned that your awareness of the river or your presence with the river started to come about when you started taking daily walks. Will you talk a little bit about the process of physically and repeatedly interacting with the river in a natural, real way, as opposed to just seeing it as another traffic obstacle?
Before I moved to Hatfield, like most people, my experience of the river was primarily from a car. And when I commuted over it, I became numb to it and would barely look at times. But to walk to it daily is to become open to a wide range of experiences, ranging from the natural world and the wildlife that is attracted to the river, from eagles and egrets to kingfishers to otters and coyotes, but also the plants, the trees, the farm fields that are along the river on either side, because it's some of the richest farmland in the United States. And to walk on that every day in every weather, for me, has just been a very powerful way to appreciate the complexity of the planet and to see and observe things that have been there all along that before this I just kind of ignored or walked by.
As someone who spent a lot of time contemplating and interacting with and writing about the river and the community around the river, how has the watershed community's relationship to the river changed over time?
Well, I think that in a community like Hatfield, which is very agricultural, I can see that in the space of a dozen years, the mix of crops has changed almost completely. We've had a constant planting of potatoes, and you see that in Hadley too. But when I moved to Hatfield, we had a major pickling plant in the region in South Deerfield for canes. And many of the fields in Hatfield were filled with beautiful peppers, banana peppers, small red hot peppers, green peppers, and cucumbers. And the pickling plant went the way of many small businesses. It was first sold to a bigger one, then it was sold to a local co-op of growers, and that did not work out. And now it's idle. And as a consequence, the land has had to change. And this has really been a pattern that we've seen over the last 300 years in how New England agriculture has had to adapt to circumstances. In a very short space of a dozen years, we've seen this process unfold in Hatfield. We went through a period of a lot of tobacco, which was really a revival. Tobacco, leaf tobacco for the wrappers of cigars, was very big at one point in both sides of the river, Hatfield and Hadley. And then it kind of died out and made a comeback for 4 or 5 years, until a couple of years ago when a virus wiped most of it out. So the potatoes have come back with a vengeance, but we also have onions and pumpkins and corn. And to me, that's part of the fascination, is to see how each year the same land is used to produce different food.
Along with being a writer, you're a visual artist. Will you talk a little bit about your visual art?
I've always been a painter. Both my parents painted, and my interest in the visual art began in my early 20s as a print journalist when I was taking photographs and doing layout and design. But I've really only become a serious painter in the last decade. And there's no question my landscape has influenced me. And it's not through a conscious process of study, but the way I absorb my landscape, my works tend to be, they veer toward the abstract. And yet I can almost always recognize patterns and shapes and textures which are in my landscape between my house and the river. And more than that, those walks and that experience of painting has really opened my eyes to how the same scene is different, not only from season to season, but hour to hour. That at 10 o'clock in the morning, a sunlit field looks entirely different from the way it looks at 5 in the afternoon.
I'm Drew Adamack. You are listening to The River Runs Through Us on Writer's Voice. Today, I am speaking with Russell Stephen Powell about his work as a publisher, writer, and artist. A lot of your paintings, to me, have a real fluidity and a current reminiscent of the river. How does the river influence your visual art?
First of all, it is a subject. The river is a place that I love to photograph, and I paint, but very rarely in a literal sense. I'm not a representational painter for the most part, but the light that the river provides and reflects is really extraordinary. And the fact that I have to walk a mile or a mile and a half to get there through farm fields, a little forest, a footbridge over the Mill River, provide really a host of landscapes for me to consider when I go to paint. And I would really say that I absorb my landscape rather than study it. I don't tend to look at a tree or look at a section of the brook and say, I'm going to go back and paint this. It works almost the opposite way. I begin to paint, and then I recognize in what I've painted a place that I walk by every day and have just kind of taken in.
You've been intimately involved with the river for decades, but a lot of people in the watershed community don't seem to have the same type of access. Do you see access barriers to the river? And if so, how do you think the community should increase access to the river?
You're correct in saying I have extraordinary access to the river. And the best I can say about that is that I don't take it lightly. I try and take advantage of it. But I do think that there are many ways available to the general public to develop a deeper appreciation for the river. There is a community rowing program in Northampton, for example. There's another one in Holyoke. They both sponsor free days every spring to encourage people to get out and see what it's like to be on the river. We have the bike path in Northampton, which begins on one side of the Connecticut, and the first thing you do is walk over the old railway bridge to cross the river. You're literally right above it. And we have the Sugarloaf Mountain, where you can have an extraordinary view, Mount Skinner, to the south. So we do have a lot of public spaces which feature the river, either intimately in a narrow cruise shell or from a high vantage point where you take in a huge expanse of not only this valley, but out to the Berkshires and north and south. So I think it's mostly just making a higher priority of our natural landscape. I think that one of the hazards of the age we live in, with this fascinating invention called the internet and our reliance on computers and other machines, is that we've distanced ourselves from the physical world. And I think there's a real risk when we do that. We have less of a grasp on what's being said to us on the internet and through our machines. If we are not familiar with that landscape ourselves, then we're more easily manipulated by those who are. Because after all, the internet is derivative of that physical planet. So I think it behooves us all to be as close to the planet and the seasons as possible.
I want to go to another area in which you work, which is agriculture, apples in particular. Will you talk about your experience with apples in New England and how they're important, both not just presently, but in the past?
Apples, I think, are unique as a food, but also as cultural icons. And we have in Western civilization myths going back to Adam and Eve, but we also have our major cultural center, New York City, as the Big Apple, and we have Apple computers as a symbol of innovation. So it's not just as a food. This fruit has beguiled us in many different ways, in many different contexts. Today, New England is a relatively small player nationally when it comes to growing apples. But there was a time when New England was very prominent and was responsible for the cultivation of a number of varieties that we still enjoy today. We have, you know, it's said that there are more than 7,500 apple varieties in the world right now. And in the research I'm doing for my new book, I'm looking at a lot of rare and extinct apples that may exist in maybe one or two orchards, maybe an abandoned orchard somewhere. Maybe some of them are extinct, but I'm always amazed at how many of these varieties persist, because I think that they represent continuity to us. And to find out that if you live in Longmeadow, that there was an apple that was discovered in Longmeadow, and it had particular features that people enjoyed for 40 or 50 years before it fell out of favor for one reason or another. I think that captivates us, and the search to find them still. And speaking of Longmeadow, we have in this Connecticut River Valley the father of American apples, John Chapman, Johnny Appleseed. Most people think of him around Leominster, where he was born, but he was actually raised in Longmeadow, Massachusetts, and that's where he spent all of his youth. So we have a deep connection to apples, both in this region and in this Connecticut River Valley.
So how do you do extinct and rare apple research?
There is a tradition of agricultural writers that I have joined but was not familiar with before I started this process. I am looking at works that date back to the 18th century. And it seems like every 40 or 50 years, there were major treatises, not on New England apples specifically, but on apple growing in the United States. And they typically include descriptions of varieties that were popular at the time. And that really gives you a good picture of how trends have changed. For example, a lot of the varieties that are ending up on this rare and extinct list, many of them had good flavor, but they all tend to have a yellow or green skin with stripes. And certainly in the modern era, the emphasis is on solid color. You want a solid red apple, a solid green apple. Even our green Granny Smith, if it's grown with a little pink blush on it, it's not seen as attractive for the marketplace. And the McIntosh, our signature apple here in New England, that's seen as a market flaw. And the apple breeders are always trying to develop a redder Mac because it's bicolor. It has both red and green. I think that's attractive, but apparently the marketers don't agree with me.
You have a new book coming out in 2014 called A Field Guide to New England Apples. Will you talk a little bit about that book and the importance of apple agriculture both in New England history and in American history?
Yeah, my first book was called America's Apple, and that really looked at the entire U.S. and looked at anything from history and cultural culinary uses to market trends. The new book will really focus on New England and the varieties that are grown here and sold here, and include a lot of history about the region. And it's intended for both the apple lover who goes to an orchard and is looking for an old variety, like Ashmead's Kernel or Roxbury Russet, but also for the shopper who goes to the grocery store and doesn't really understand the differences between a Braeburn and a Fuji and is not sure which one to buy and what they're good for. So the guide will serve both purposes. But one of the reasons that I think that apple growing continues to be important for New England in this age is that it greatly impacts our quality of life. Because of the land involved and because of the location of these orchards, when we lose one, it is a significant loss to the community. It's certainly a loss if a shoe factory goes and we lose jobs and it hurts the local economy. But that brick factory building is not a huge loss. It occupies a fairly limited space. An apple orchard is hundreds of acres. And it may, in fact, be one of the reasons that we chose to live in this particular community in the first place, because of the beautiful fruit that appears every year. And our orchards continue to function almost like quasi-public parks. Where else can you go for hours on end without paying a penny and wander through nature and see bluebirds and eagles and turkeys and smell the incredible fragrance that you get in the middle of an orchard, and maybe come home at the end of the day with a bag of apples? It's really a remarkable experience, and the farmer essentially provides that to the public for free.
I'm Drew Adamack. You are listening to The River Runs Through Us on Writer's Voice. Today, I am speaking with Russell Stephen Powell about his work as a publisher, writer, and artist. What are your concerns for the future of the Connecticut River?
It's not so much that I have concerns for the river itself. I think there are a lot of good people, as this series has shown, who are heavily invested in preserving and protecting the natural assets of the river, and I fully support those. To me, the larger issue, and it's one that I address frequently in my work, is this distance that we are putting between ourselves and the natural experience. And I mentioned computers earlier, but it comes into play with things like some of the machines that we purchase for the sake of convenience that are really luxuries, whether it's something like a leaf blower, which uses gas, makes noise through an entire neighborhood, stirs up all kinds of toxic elements into the air, and it maybe saves the homeowner 15 minutes or 20 minutes a week. We plant these gorgeous trees in our yard because we love their shade, we love to look at them, we love the fall foliage, and then we have issues with the fact that the leaves drop and we have to rake those leaves. What could be a very rich, sensual experience of the outdoors, of raking those leaves, which, by the way, would also give us some exercise. Instead, we buy these foolish machines which have the effect of distancing us from the very planet we live on. And it becomes an extreme example on the computer and the internet. And I love both inventions. I rely on them. I use them every day extensively. Certainly for this book, I am doing a lot of my research on the internet. But I think that we pay a deep price when we distance ourselves from the planet in the process. And I think that we have to be disciplined at times and take extraordinary efforts to make sure that we're not doing things for the sake of what we call convenience that are not only inconvenient, but just put us at a great disadvantage.
I spoke to Nyla Maria last episode about a walk that she took, and I asked her this question. She gave a beautiful answer, so I'll ask you the same question. What advice would you give to someone who has that distance from the natural world? What advice would you give to someone who wanted to start experiencing the river in the kinds of ways that you're talking about?
Well, the best way I know is to get a dog. If you have a dog, you are compelled to walk it every single day. There's nothing better, I think, to experience all kinds of weather and to kind of force you to get out from behind your computer, from the sedentary lives that many of us have come to lead. First would be to get a dog. Not everybody can do that, I understand. But I think that's one way to have the decision made for you. Beyond that, I would say that it's really a question of just not being frivolous about it, about taking it seriously and not saying that if I get out for a walk on one day, that there, I've done it. Now I've seen the river. I think it's important to build this into your life and do that. We're able to do that for the things we consider important. So I think that if people view seeing the natural world, getting out to the river as important, then make a commitment to it, to at least once a week. You can at least get out once on the weekend. And I think if you start to do that, you begin to see more and more reasons why you would want to do this more often. So, you know, if you can't get a dog, make this a priority. Be disciplined about it the way you would anything else in your life. Make a commitment to it.
Will you talk about the importance of presence and attention and mindfulness that you get out of nature and that you get out of committing to experiencing nature on a regular basis?
It's another thing that I think we've entrapped ourselves in is a kind of perpetual complaint about the weather. And we see that now during the summer when people want to air condition everything. And many people go from an air-conditioned home to an air-conditioned car to an air-conditioned office. And then they wonder why it feels hot out when they are without those things. And for centuries of human life, we dealt with the elements and we became used to them. We built up tolerance. We came up with interesting ways to deal with things like the heat. And now it's become just kind of one more opportunity to screen ourselves from the planet. And it works through all the seasons. When we're in the winter, we're too cold. When we're in the summer, we're too hot. And we never seem comfortable in the moment. But it's in those experiences, those day-to-day experiences of hot, cold, rain, snow, wind, that we really deepen and broaden our experience. And again, the danger of putting ourselves in these cocoons is that the range of our experience is very narrow. And to someone particularly who's interested in writing or painting or photography or any kind of artistic impulse, you want to be able to have as broad and deep an experience of the sensory world as possible. So that's another reason that the landscape has been so attractive to me and why I make a commitment to get out there every day.
If listeners want to read your work or see your visual art, where would they go?
The best place to be introduced to my work is my weblog, which is Russ Powell, RussPowell.net. And from there, I have links to some of the other weblogs I produce, including one for the Apple Growers, which is published weekly from August to December.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Drew Adamack talking with writer, artist, and agricultural historian Russell Powell. Go to writersvoice.net to hear Powell read from his essay, Border Crossings. Next up, we revisit highlights of our special series on the historical, spiritual, and creative influence in this, our last episode of The River Runs Through Us. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Since October 2012, Writer's Voice has been running a special six-part mini-series exploring the literature, spirit, and meaning of the Connecticut River for those who live within its watershed. The river has fostered much of what we recognize as the modern world in New England. It stretches for over 400 miles from northern New Hampshire to the Long Island Sound. Millions of people live within the river's basin, an area of 11,000 square miles. Our series, The River Runs Through Us, has explored the creative, metaphorical, and historical lens of the Connecticut River by engaging writers, artists, and scholars in a long-form public conversation. Today, we end our series with a look back at some highlights. First up, Drew Adamek talked with historian Carrie Buckley about the wider role of the Connecticut in the region. Buckley is the director of the museum, Historic Northampton. He says the original Native American inhabitants of the Connecticut River Valley had a different relationship to the river than the colonials.
Early on, the Connecticut River was populated by Native Americans who really considered the River Valley their homeland. They were really connected to the valley by a sense of place. They didn't consider themselves a people of destiny, but a people connected to the place where they lived, to kinship groups and what they called homelands. Of course, the Europeans had a very different point of view. They saw the vast interior as a vacuum domicilium, a vast wasteland, empty, ready for settlement. The Native Americans believed that their identity really rested in the homelands that they inhabited. They were part of a kind of a spiritual environment. Manitou was the word that they used, which animated all of nature, human beings as well as animals, and inanimate objects like mountains and rivers and so forth. The colonial settlers used the river as a means of transportation. They saw it as a trade route. They saw it as a highway into the interior. Certainly, they followed the fur trade. And it was also a means of transportation to sell their surplus produce and agricultural products to the wider Atlantic world. So there was a kind of certainly a difference in feeling and orientation about the river based on cultural differences, religious differences, political differences.
How has the Connecticut River been depicted historically in the arts, in the humanities, over the course of its history, or our history with it, rather?
Natural beauty really wasn't appreciated until it began to disappear, in a sense. For the Puritans, nature was wild, it was untamed, vaguely satanic. It was to be kept at bay. The river was fairly utilitarian. But you began to have an infusion of ideas about landscape coming from the Romantics in Europe. Timothy Dwight, president of Yale, traveled through New England writing an early travel guide and recognized the Connecticut River Valley as having a sense of beauty, the intervals along the river being especially pleasing. And the prospect from Mount Holyoke began to draw visitors who saw below them the balance, the middle landscape, the balance between raw nature and civilization. And this was what attracted painters like Thomas Cole. And you can see his view of the Connecticut River, the Oxbow, and the American wing at the Metropolitan Museum today, a huge canvas. The view is from the top of Mount Holyoke, looking over the valley, looking at the Oxbow. And this was painted in the 1830s. And again, it's that middle landscape, the picturesque, the balance between cultivation and the wilderness. The thing that you don't see are the factories and industrialization. And in a sense, this appreciation of nature began to take hold at the very moment that industrialization was transforming the landscape.
So how did the process of industrialization affect the river and the river valley?
The river was kind of the lifeblood for trade up until the Revolution, consisting mostly of agricultural products, cattle and wheat and flax. This did a number of things. It facilitated trade, certainly, but it also made it economically feasible for factories to be developed along the tributaries of the Connecticut River. Water power was New England's first contribution to the industrial development. Industrial development began in New England because of the water power. And the Industrial Revolution began in tributaries like the Mill River. So you begin to have startups like this along the tributaries, the Mill River, for instance. You had woolen factories, button factories, paper mills, daguerreotype case makers. Eventually, the silk industry developed along the tributaries. And up until the 1820s, the river was the best means of transportation, the only means of transportation.
Next, Susan Stinson talked with Drew about her novel Spider in a Tree. It's about the fiery 18th century preacher Jonathan Edwards, who preached and lived in the River Valley city, Northampton. The novel has just been published by Small Beer Press.
Susan, in writing this book, you're talking about people that have been dead for several hundred years.
Yeah.
And yet you are literally in their space. You are literally in the places in which they walked.
Yeah.
So how did being in the space that these characters lived in, these very real characters, inform your work? How did it shape what you were writing about, and how did it, particularly the natural world, shape what you were doing?
Well, in many ways. I mean, part of the research for the book for me, I was involved. I wrote outside a lot, so I was out in the landscape all the time. And I read Jonathan Edwards outside. I read other pieces of the historical record outside. And every time an insect would come along and land on my skin, I had to stop everything else that I was doing and pay really strict attention to exactly what that insect was doing. I didn't swat it. I took notes, and I took really careful notes for as long as it would stay with me. It turned out to be an intensely meditative thing to do. And those insects, one of the things that they became were sort of these amazing, like, angels from the past, like direct connection to Jonathan Edwards, because I realized that that would give me all sorts of sensory experiences that 18th century people in this place would have too. Another example of how the landscape shaped me and shaped the book was that not long ago, when I was trying to revise the book and get a really solid passage about the description of the layout of the town, I went around sunset and rode my tricycle. I have an adult tricycle, back and forth across the bridge over the Connecticut at sunset. And that's right about where there wasn't a bridge, but it was the ferry. But that's right about where they would have come in to town. This young 14-year-old girl, who I'm calling Nia, who Jonathan Edwards had just paid for and bought from a slave ship captain in Newport, Rhode Island. So he's bringing her to Northampton for the first time. And in the book, I needed to be in Jonathan Edwards' point of view. So a lot of this imagery didn't make it into the book, but crossing the bridge, it was windy. The trees were sort of billowing like waves in the ocean. It was suggesting like her trip that she had taken not long ago to me, like across the ocean, and how that might look to her. The sun was going out down. Many people were out on the bridge to look at the sun over the river. You know, you could see the mountains in the distance, and I could smell the river, and all of it, except for the fact that I was on a trike, most of it, would be things that they could have experienced, you know? Except for, you know, as the water keeps moving, it's never the same water. It's never exactly the same, but the link is there.
Susan Stinson, talking about her just-published novel, Spider in a Tree. You can read an excerpt by going to writersvoice.net. The great anti-slavery preacher Sojourner Truth came to Northampton, Massachusetts from New York City, where she found friendship and work in a utopian community that produced silk in the small Northampton suburb Florence. I spoke with historian Nell Painter in episode 2 of our series, The River Runs Through Us.
The Northampton community was in a great big industrial building, and people shared work. Everybody worked. There were sort of dormitories. The Northampton Association really was founded along lines of equality and sharing. So women were equal and black people were equal. They talked out what they were going to do. It was like a big co-op. And so when she first came there and she saw how sort of primitive the living situation was, she really didn't think she was going to stay very long. But the people were so open and really welcoming to her that she decided to stay. And over the course of a few years, she began to think as they did. It would be very difficult for an African American in those times, in the 1840s, to be pro-slavery. So Jenner Truth would have had some anti-slavery ideas, so it wasn't a big shift for her. But she began to speak less about the Holy Spirit, less about the end of the world, less about religious ideas, though she never quite gave them up, and more about equal rights and the evils of slavery.
Nell Painter says the Northampton Association's commitment to abolition grew out of its philosophy about work and class.
The idea was to abolish class differences and class oppression and to have people work together and talk together so that everybody would work, nobody would be exempted, there would not be an elite that just lay around. And so the people of the Northampton Association were very much against slavery, largely because of its class bias, that it was so corrupt and oppressive for working people.
And so what would a typical day be like for Sojourner Truth there at the Northampton Association?
She worked in the laundry, so she was not involved in silk production. Everybody would have gotten up very early and probably taken their baths in the cold river and then gone to their various jobs. A man who was a child in the Northampton Association later made a drawing of her at the washtub from memory or from imagination. So she would have probably worked all day doing the laundry. She complained when people gave her clothes that were too dirty or too much. And then they would have had uplifting visitors and talks and meetings and then met together in the evening to decide who was going to do what and how the association was going to proceed on a daily basis.
Historian Nell Painter. She's the author of the biography, Sojourner Truth, A Life, A Symbol. Next, we hear a clip from my interview with Sarah Kilborn, author of American Phoenix, a biography of the great 19th century silk magnate William Skinner and her great-grandfather. Here, Kilborn tells us about the flood that wiped out Skinner's first factory on the Mill River, a tributary of the Connecticut. I asked her to describe the scene.
On the morning of May 16, 1874, George Cheney, the gatekeeper of the dam, was sitting down to breakfast with his family, and his father looked out the window and saw a chunk of the dam slough off and pass away downstream. And he immediately shouted to his son to go check on the dam, look at the dam. And George ran out. He noticed that water was already beginning to percolate through the exposed earth. And he opened up the sluice pipe to try to relieve pressure on the dam and then immediately jumped onto his horse and raced 3 miles down the valley to the nearest town, Williamsburg, to alert his boss, the general manager of the dam, Onslow Spellman, that he thought the dam was giving way. And Spellman doesn't believe Cheney and says, well, if you really believe that the dam is giving way, then you go yourself warn the people below. And Cheney was exasperated. He couldn't ride his horse any further. The horse was spent. A milkman, a dairy farmer, rode into town about that time and, you know, was so struck by the appearance of the gatekeeper. The dairy farmer named Collins Graves said, I'll go warn the people below. You warn the folks here in Williamsburg. I'll go warn the people below. They all thought that they had plenty of time to do all this warning. They assumed that, well, the reservoir was filled with 600 million gallons of water. It covered 111 acres. It was going to take a long time for that water to drain down the countryside. And they thought it would be passing or entering Williamsburg at about noon, and this is before 8 o'clock in the morning. They had no idea that the reservoir was less than 10 minutes away. So Collins Graves goes down, and he rides his his dairy cart. He still has milk cans, you know, in his buggy.
And they're falling out. He's just clattering down the road.
Yeah, he's clattering down the road. The milk cans are falling out. Graves rides his buggy downstream, and he rides as close as he can to the mills, and he shouts, the Williamsburg Reservoir is giving way, the reservoir is giving way, and then begins shouting, to the hills, to the hills, to the hills. Then he went down to Skinnerville, and he warned the villagers in Skinnerville. He warned William Skinner, and he warned the factory workers at the silk mill. He was about 5 minutes ahead of the water at that time. And when he got to Haydenville, the next village, he was barely 2 minutes ahead of the water. And the water caught up to him in Haydenville. And this other man, Myron Day, at the bottom of Haydenville, looked up, saw the water coming into the village. And he's the one who took the alarm and raced further downstream with it to warn everybody that, oh my God, the reservoir is on its way. It's here.
Tell us what this wall of water was like. This was like a tsunami.
Yes, it was an extraordinary inland tidal wave. It was 20 to 40 feet high. At points, it was 300 feet wide. And it was a plow coming down the mountainside. So it was just churning up the entire country below it. And it was just filled with absolutely everything. It was filled with trees and mud and rocks and boulders, massive boulders that had been in place for centuries were uprooted by this wave. It was picking up mills, farm animals, tools, people, children, everything in its path it picked up and took. And in regard to those who died in the flood, you either lived or you died. If you got caught in the waters, you died. If you escaped to the hillside, you lived. There were few people that were simply hurt. That water went through the upper villages in the valley of Williamsburg, Skinnerville, and Haydenville, and Leeds in 15 minutes each. And Skinnerville suffered the worst destruction of any village in the valley. They did say it had been obliterated from the face of the earth. It had been annihilated. It was a wasteland. It was an apocalyptic expanse of just sand and stones, and everything in Skinnerville was swept off and, landed throughout the rest of the valley miles away.
Sarah Skinner Kilborn, author of American Phoenix. The disaster she told us about forced William Skinner to look elsewhere, and the new nearby city of Holyoke, Massachusetts, offered to build him a new factory on very favorable terms. Skinner took the deal and helped build Holyoke into one of the greatest industrial cities of America and the world. The river as an engine of industrialization is something labor historian Tom Jurevich talked about with Drew Adamack in the fourth episode of our series, The River Runs Through Us.
I spoke to a historian earlier in the show who called the Connecticut River and its tributary towns sort of the birthplace of the American Industrial Revolution. What is that relationship like in your mind between the river and the birth of American industry like?
I think we often look at the Connecticut River as a source of transportation or recreation, but I think we need to remember that it was water power that fueled the Industrial Revolution in the U.S. And when this began, in places like Waltham and Lowell and Lawrence, but quickly moved to the Connecticut Valley as well, in towns like Turner's Falls or in Holyoke. And what I think we need to remember is that these were planned industrial communities to exploit water power. And in each of these, there's a series of canals. And the canals, the Power Canal in Turner's Falls and the series of upper and lower canals in Holyoke, weren't used for transportation, but they were used as the sources, the energy sources, for the factories that grew in those towns.
And what influence did the geography of these towns and their use of water power, what influence did that have on the creation of American industrial power? What kind of industries were created as a result of where they were?
Well, it's very interesting. If we start north, first in Turner's Falls, and again, the power canal that diverts water from the Connecticut River, and then the water would fall from the power canal in the basement of those factories and power turbines that would then power. And the John Russell Cutlery was, in fact, at one point, the largest cutlery in North America. And it created the knives and the forks that were part of becoming, in some ways, a civilized American society. The Bowie knife was created in Turner's Falls and later in Greenfield. So these were very important parts of the industry. The two other threads that we need to follow in the Connecticut River Valley, the most important being that it quickly became a machine tool capital, really of North America. And machine tools, those are the tools that are used to make other tools, capital goods, as the economists call them, were part of a thriving economy later, all the way from Springfield, Vermont, all the way through Connecticut. And the Connecticut Valley was indeed a leader in those machine tools, which then built the machines to fuel the rest of the economy.
Tom Jurevich. Jurevich teaches labor studies and sociology at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst. Next, we look at the Connecticut River through the lens of nature. Science and nature writer Nyla Moreira talks about the artistic inspiration she draws from the river and reads her short story, Alaska, Massachusetts.
Well, this piece was born out of just a regular walk. I had my binoculars with me like I always do, and it's down in an area of Northampton known as the Meadows, which has a lot of farm fields and a beautiful view of the Connecticut River and the Holyoke Range. So I was taking my walk, and this piece was born out of something that happened to me there. So this piece is called Alaska, Massachusetts, and it appeared in The Common, which is a literary magazine based in Amherst, Massachusetts, out of Amherst College. Beyond the bridge of Highway 91, beyond the levee in the last line of houses at the outskirts of town, civilization goes to rural scenes. First, you pass a patch of low trees, then a small paddock and a barn where two horses live, and then you come to the cornfields, wide, flat, golden, and stubbly by the riparian woodland of the Connecticut River. I've always wanted to come to these fields to see the stars, but the landscape is lonely, and I would be afraid to come here alone at night. Just beyond the Connecticut, the Holyoke Range climbs abruptly. Standing on the riverbank, you can gaze over the wide, swiftly flowing dark water to see Summit House perched at the top of its steep rise. From Summit House, you can look down from the balcony and watch the teenagers on their ATVs barreling down the muddy tracks of these cornfields. ATVs are a common sight here. Today, at the start of my walk, I encountered several small ones rattling by, manned by a couple of imps no older than 8. Their parents lounged beside their pickup trucks and talked and waited for their children. As I made my way along the dirt track into the lonelier fields, 3 larger ones roared up behind me. I resent when they do that. No matter how far I stroll, they always seem to find me out. And they unnerve me. They are so big and so inescapable, driving me down, their occupants bulked and masked under their helmets and thick coats. I paused on the icy track, waiting for the riders to choose a side, then withdrew cautiously to the other one. But as they drove by, they peered through their visors to make eye contact with me and raised their hands in greeting. So I greeted them in return and felt less uneasy, even a little sheepish for my fears. The prize of the walk, though, came as I was approaching the river. By its banks lies a smaller field, offset from the others, and bare of corn stubble. In summer, it probably bears potatoes or cucumbers. As I walked past it, I heard another pair of ATVs charging up behind me. More, I thought, grumpily. Then I heard a rough bark, and then another. I turned, and tearing across the field, at top speed, lanky and long-legged, tall and lean, came a full dog team harnessed to the front of an ATV. They raced towards me, beautiful, sleek, their faces in the most enormous of grins. Their tongues lolled a mile, flapping backward from their parted jaws from the speed of their running. Their eyes bulged so wide the whites shone. A couple were huskies, but others represented a variety of dog types, all big and slim, a motley but muscular crew. I stood aside to let them pass, marveling at a scene that seemed to belong to Alaska more than to rural Massachusetts. Two adults rode the first ATV, one leaning over the handlebars, the other half standing and holding the driver by the shoulders. They raised their hands to me in a high salute. Behind them, a smaller ATV held a couple of teenagers. I waved in delight. After rounding the bend, they paused, perhaps to let the dogs rest, because the team looked exhausted. But the dogs didn't want to stop. For a moment, they stood patiently. Then one or two let out impatient barks. They began to jump in their harnesses, to strain forward, to leap. So their people returned to the throttle and off they raced, around the field, down into the hollow at the far side, and, returning on the opposite side, up a low rise, the dogs stretching and leaping to surmount the slope. Then they were gone, like hounds of the underworld, vanishing into a barren landscape, only the very tops of their heads visible above the far hedges, and then, at last, not at all.
Science and Nature writer Nyla Moreira. Finally, what is the prognosis for the Connecticut River? Back when I first moved to the region in 1984, the river was more polluted than it is today. In 1997, the entire Connecticut River watershed was designated as the Silvio Oconte National Fish and Wildlife Refuge. Andrew Fisk, executive director of the Connecticut River Watershed Council, talked about his prognosis for the future of the river in the next 20 to 50 years. He spoke with Drew back in Episode 5 of The River Runs Through Us.
When we look back at what we've done, we're exceedingly inspired. I'm exceedingly inspired. And I think that I can approach the question of where is the Connecticut River going in the next 20 years with a great sense of optimism. Because I think we've engaged in these questions as groups of citizens. We've made very important decisions. We've thrown a whole lot of coin at these problems. You know, if you think about just building wastewater treatment plants and building sewers that work effectively, hundreds of millions of dollars have been put in the river since the 70s, and it's made an astonishing difference. So I think we recognize that we're able to put our money where our mouth is. When we do that, we realize results. Now, the problems don't go away. In many instances, they get more complicated. But I think if we build on what we've done, we can recognize we've got the technical savvy, we've got the civic interest, and if we think about it carefully, we have the resources to apply to these questions. And I think that last one's very important, because as you solve environmental problems, they get more expensive as you approach the last 10% or the last 5%. The financial questions become more acute, which means our conversations have to be more earnest about how we invest money over time and how we invest that money in the most cost-effective way, because we do have to look 10, 20 years out. None of these questions are 1 or 2 year questions. A long vantage point is what we require. And I think our past successes say, we can do this.
That was Andrew Fisk of the Connecticut River Watershed Council. You can hear any or all of the episodes in our special series, The River Runs Through Us, by going to writersvoice.net. Our deep thanks go out to Mass Humanities for providing the funding for this project. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.